Anya moved silently through the darkness, only a few steps behind Mackenzie. The three-quarter moon hung overhead, but it was dimmed by scudding clouds. They had left the camels back at the abandoned fort. If things went badly, it was a long run back to an escape route. The weight of the AK-47 across Anya's shoulders was a grim reminder that things were definitely going to get worse before they got better. She carried extra magazines for the weapon in the tactical Kevlar vest she wore. They crept through the mountainous land and took advantage of the boulders and stunted trees that grew in sparse patches. Mustafa would have sentries posted. Mackenzie hoped to spot those sentries before their party was spotted. The fact that there were so few mercenaries was both an asset and a liability. There was less likelihood of being seen, but there was also considerably less manpower. The minutes passed as Anya counted the steps they took. She was up to over 1,000. They should be coming up on the Bedouin camp soon. The GPS locators were still working and had remained fixed. They crested a ridge, and she spotted a soft bubble of light to the west of their position. Her heart lifted and filled with dread at the same time. They were going to know shortly if Smythe and the others were alive. Mackenzie turned to the team and waved them into position. Lying on her stomach, Anya took her micro-binoculars and focused on the glowing light bubble only a little more than 100 yards away. The images blurred for a moment as she adjusted the magnification, then she brought the camp into focus. Several campfires lit up the site. Bedouin warriors sat hunkered around the fires or near tents. A makeshift corral lay to the east, where the horses grazed on grass and leaves. The men were armed. Anya made herself breathe slowly as she gazed around the camp. After a moment, she spotted David Smythe sitting just inside a lean-to against one of the foothills. He sat leaning forward, his hands bound behind his back. He looked worse for wear, haggard, his clothing disheveled. Bruising stained one side of his face, and the deep purple coloring told Anya that the injury was fresh. Mackenzie touched her arm, drawing her attention. He pointed at one of the other tents. Anya trained her binoculars there and saw the woman inside, Teresa Templeton. A moment later, she spotted other students from the dig. Smythe was talking to someone inside the tent. A moment later, a Bedouin warrior pulled the tent flap back and went in with a pot and a handful of bowls. During that brief moment, Anya caught sight of Corey and Suad and several other members of the dig team.
Are they all there?
Looks like it.
Then you got lucky. The Bedouins must have taken a few supplies from your dig site. That's the only way they could have supported this many hostages.
Yahya lay on the ground beside Mackenzie, surveying the camp.
How many Bedouin?
31.
I count 29.
I do too. Very good, Anya.
Shit, some of them are always moving.
Yes, they are.
Retreating on his hands and knees, Mackenzie climbed back from the ridge. He put his binoculars back in his chest pack. Anya followed him, trailed by Yahya.
We have our work cut out for us.
Outnumbered almost 3-1?
3-1 doesn't bother me. We have surprise on our side for a little while. We can cut down the odds with that. The problem remains whether they decide to fight us or kill their hostages.
We don't have a choice. We can't leave them here.
All right, then let's get to this.
The curtain bar had a fully equipped op room in the basement. Hendricks knew he should have expected that, but he was still surprised. He supposed he should have been more surprised that Sophie had showed it to him. The latest computer equipment filled the room, leaving little space for the casual observer, though Hendricks was certain that nothing casual ever took place in that room. Two people, both young, one male and one female, sat in front of an array of monitors. Their hands darted back and forth across their touchscreens, gesturing to pull up files rather than typing. The images cycled very quickly, showing exploded views of a desertscape at night, as well as views from high overhead. Human forms glowed on the main screen that filled one whole wall. There were two groups, and the illuminated forms stood revealed in red and blue. Hendricks quickly deduced that Anya Creed and Rafe McKenzie's group ringed the Bedouin camp. As he watched, a man inside a lean-to was suddenly limned in yellow. Immediately following, a rectangular space popped open on another screen and quickly filled in with a head-and-shoulder shot of a guy who looked worn to the bone. beside that rectangle, another opened up, and hundreds of photos started cycling through. An instant later, the image froze, producing one that looked a lot like the captured image from the Bedouin camp. Data scrolled underneath the picture. The female tech spoke up as she continued to gesture at the computer console.
I have one of the dig team identified.
Ping them separately. I want to keep track of everyone there.
Sophie sat beside Hendricks at a small observation area in the back of the room. As always, she looked stylish and elegant. Her attention was divided between the operation in the room and the tablet computer in her hands.
Who is that?
Sophie flicked a finger at her tablet. An instant later, an image floated onto the computer monitor set in the table in front of him. Hendricks studied Professor David Smythe in both pictures.
Well, at least he's still alive.
Yes.
What about Habib?
Sophie tapped her tablet again, and an image of the camp and the surrounding countryside opened up.
No one followed Creed or Mackenzie out of Marrakesh. The man isn't as interested in your archaeologist as you believed he was.
No, that can't be. Habib's communiques about Anya Creed were very detailed.
He could have been baiting you.
Why? I don't have an investment in this mission other than to reach Habib.
I don't know. If I'd had more time to properly plan this, I might have found another angle we could have played.
No, this is the only thing we've had on Habib in years. The man is a ghost. We only see him after he's struck, or when he wants us to.
What do you want me to do?
What do you mean?
Mackenzie might not represent much to the CIA these days, but when things turn bloody, he's one of my top operators. I don't want to lose him on a wild goose chase. I could scrub this before we lose anyone.
And just leave these people to their fates?
They might catch a bullet during the ensuing confrontation anyway. There are no guarantees how this will turn out. I'm not running a charity here. If we proceed, this will still count toward that favor I owe you.
Let's go.
I'm glad you said that. I'm still willing to pursue Habib in another way if you can come up with one. I don't mind having a high-profile agent in the CIA owe me one.
Sophie tapped the earwig she wore.
Dove, your operation is cleared. Begin extraction. This should be entertaining.
Silently, Hendricks watched as Rafe Mackenzie and his men crept in. He'd lost track of which of the red figures was Anya Creed. Two snipers remained at the ridgeline, each armed with heavy-caliber Barrett rifles capable of shooting holes in cinderblock walls and armored vehicles. The rest of the mercenaries advanced with Mackenzie. They followed the incline of the hill and stayed behind boulders and scrub grass as much as they could. An added advantage, the proximity of the campfires would dull the Bedouin warriors' night vision. Carrying the AK-47 in front of her, Anya stayed to Mackenzie's left as she crept down the incline. 30 yards ahead of them, a Bedouin guard sat on a rock and stared out at the night, looking right at them, except he couldn't see them. Then, abruptly, his body language changed as he sat up straighter and took a new grip on his assault rifle. The earwig in Anya's ear picked up Mackenzie's quiet order. He had given her the device only moments ago and told her to stay off the frequency unless she needed him. None of the mercenaries talked, but Anya had heard a woman's voice briefly acknowledge Mackenzie and inform him the operation was clear. Anya had been told the woman was tech support. It made sense that someone would need to manage the satellite uplink, but she couldn't help wondering where the uplink was coming from.
Take the sentries down, now!
The sniper in front of Anya suddenly dropped in his tracks as his head exploded. A split second later, his companion also fell to the ground. Mackenzie took up position behind a rocky shelf.
All right, everybody dig in, make your shots count.
Anya lay on her stomach as she pulled the AK-47 to her shoulder. She followed a Bedouin running for cover, settled her sights over him, and squeezed the trigger. The bullet caught the Bedouin somewhere in the chest and spun him off balance, sprawling him to the ground. Inside the lean-to, David Smythe fell forward, his hands still bound behind him. Nadim lurched up, then quickly fell on Suad, covering the boy with his body. Unwilling to leave those people undefended, Anya took two more shots and put down a second man, but missed a third. Then she got her feet under her and ran in a wide circle around the camp.
Hey, what do you think you're doing?
Saving the people we came here to save.
Anya ran through the darkness as fast as she could. Hendricks struggled to keep track of all the movement on the large monitor, but in the end, there was just too much happening. The red and blue figures and the yellow hostages moved too quickly for him to follow.
What is she doing? She's going to get herself killed.
Suddenly, the image on the screen flickered and changed. The Bedouin camp shrank, and immense darkness pooled around it as the view telescoped back.
There's a bogey in the area.
What bogey?
An airplane has entered the encounter zone.
Even as Hendricks searched the monitor for an airplane, the craft lit up. The coloration changed to a uniform steel gray that lifted the plane out of the night.
Do we know its origins?
Sophie continued attacking her tablet. Shadows tumbled from the plane as it maintained a heading that would take it near the Bedouin camp. Parachutes.
It's Habib.
Habib has access to these kinds of people and hardware?
This is why we were after the man, Sophie. We don't know everything he has. All we know is that he has a personal fortune and is tied to several Shiite movements.
Well, then this little fishing expedition of yours is going to cost us more than we had anticipated. Mackenzie and his people might be able to handle the Bedouin, but not this.
Have Mackenzie get Anyakrit out of there. If we can hold on to her, we might still have something.
Anya circled behind the lean-to, watching the Bedouins go down under the withering fire of Mackenzie and his troop. Bodies lay sprawled among the large tents, while the combatants tried to hole up around natural defenses like boulders and low ridges. As Anya closed in, bullets ripped through the fabric. Two Bedouins sprinted for the lean-to. Neither one was Mustafa. One of Mackenzie's people, a woman, ran toward them, firing at another Bedouin behind a small rock pile on the other side of a fire pit. She didn't see the two Bedouin running toward the lean-to until it was too late. They lifted their weapons. Knocked off balance by their bullets, the woman tried to find cover, but the Kevlar body armor only protected her to a point. She managed three steps, then collapsed. By that time, Anya had her rifle up, and the first of the Bedouin was in her sights. Anya stitched a handful of rounds across the man's chest, and he looked down at his body in surprise as he fell. The other Bedouin managed to slide behind a hill. Anya fired a few rounds at the ground along the ridge to keep him pinned down as she raced for the back of the lean-to. Transferring her rifle to her left hand, she seized the sword out of the otherwear and slashed vertically through the thick canvas. Another slash, this one horizontal at chin height, freed the canvas to fall in on itself as she released the sword. The darkness inside was splintered by the fires in the center of the camp. David Smythe, Corey Burcell, the other graduate students, and a Katara craftsman lay on the ground. One of them held his hands to his wounded leg. Suad recognized their rescuer first.
Anya!
The boy tried to push up from the ground, but his father kept him down. A Bedouin appeared in the doorway and brought up his rifle. Anya managed to get her weapon up first and squeezed the trigger. The rounds froze the man in place, then he dropped. Anya stepped to one side of the opening and covered the front of the lean-to with her weapon.
Come on! Get out of there!
Nadim released his son, and Suad bounded out, followed immediately by his father. The others poured from the structure, with Smythe and Corey Burcell bringing up the rear.
Where do we go?
Into the mountains. Anywhere away from here.
Anya fired again as two more Bedouin approached. Smythe got the graduate students moving. Corey paused at Anya's side as she reloaded.
They've got Tracer.
I know. I'll get her.
We'll get her.
Corey stayed low and ran parallel behind the row of Bedouin tents. As she watched her rescuees scatter, Anya glanced up at Smythe and saw that the group was getting away easily. No one had spotted them. She ran after Corey. Then she heard the woman's voice again over the earwig.
Dove, we have a problem.
What?
Airborne troops headed your way.
In disbelief, Anya looked up and almost tripped over loose rocks. She caught herself and kept moving. For a moment, she didn't see anything. Then, only because the parachutes blotted out the stars behind them, she spotted the arrivals. She paused beside Corey at the back of the tent that housed the women.
Where's your knife?
Anya bent as if she was picking up something from the ground, then pulled the sword from the otherwear and slashed through the tent.
Where did you find that?
On the ground.
I don't know how I missed it.
Get them out of here. We have to go.
Corey tore away at the fabric. Anya felt sure their situation was about to get a lot worse. When he spotted the parachutists, Mackenzie could barely suppress his rage.
Who are those people?
We believe they belong to your target.
Mackenzie counted 18 parachutes. There were probably more he missed. If they had been sent by Habib ibn Thabit, the man wasn't wasting time. Mackenzie sighted through his rifle's sights and bracketed another Bedouin's head as the guy ran toward the tent. This was the last place Mackenzie had seen Anya Creed heading. He squeezed the trigger and watched the Bedouin spill forward in a jumble of arms and legs. Mackenzie got up and ran toward the camp. Judging from the descent rate of the parachutes, they'd be among them in short order.
Is he with them?
We don't know.
But it's not very likely, is it?
No.
Mackenzie went into the camp in a crouch, half-stepping quickly the way the military had taught him, keeping the rifle up while keeping himself mobile and as small as he could.
Given the changing parameters of your current mission, we've chosen a new objective for you.
What?
Get Anya Creed out of there.
That could be a problem.
You're not paid to point out problems. You're supposed to solve them.
Mackenzie changed his course and headed for Anya Creed's position behind the tent. She was linked in over the comm. She would know he'd be coming and what he intended to do. The chill passed through Anya when she heard the order. It was the first true indication she'd had that Mackenzie wasn't calling his own shots.
Let's go! Let's go!
Corey reached through the back of the tent, grabbing for the graduate students and hustling them along. Anya had been looking out for the Bedouin warriors. Now she had to add Mackenzie and his crew to that list. And the parachutists. Anya sensed the present above her before she saw the parachutist and brought her rifle to bear as she looked up. He swooped in on her like a predatory bird, letting go of one of the guide controls and reaching for the machine pistol holstered across his abdomen. Bracketing him in her sights, Anya squeezed the trigger. The bullets caused him to jerk reflexively, thinking that he, like her, might be wearing Kevlar body armor. She put the next burst into his face. Anya barely had time to dive to the side as he fell. She rolled to her feet and came up with the rifle awkwardly, but she still had it. Swiveling, staying low, she wheeled around to where the parachutist lay on the mountainside 20 feet away. The parachute twisted in the breeze for a moment, then gave a final flutter and draped over the man. He didn't move. Corey was on his way up the mountain.
Anya! Come on!
More are coming!
Teresa pointed into the sky. Anya spotted 10 or 15 more parachutists dropping out of the night. Few Bedouin warriors remained to engage them, and most were trying to escape. Anya thought wistfully of Abdelilah Karam's scroll, the part she didn't have and wished she knew where to look. But the first priority was the safety of the archaeological team. She turned and ran. Only a short distance ahead, though, she saw that there was no place to run. More parachutists landed ahead of them, dropping from the sky like ravens. Several of them fired bursts over their heads, driving them to the ground. Anya pulled up behind a ridge with Teresa and Corey. Corey peered over the ridge at the airborne troops who were already shrugging out of their parachute harnesses.
Oh man, we are so screwed. Until you shot that guy, I thought they were here to rescue us. Who are they?
I don't know.
And who are the guys you're out here with? Friends of yours?
Not exactly.
Anya peered over the ridge, searching for an escape route. The parachute arrivals were digging in, setting up a perimeter, and cutting off any forward advance.
Anya, I know you can hear me.
It would probably be better if you stayed away from me right now.
Anya peered through the darkness, searching for Mackenzie. She didn't know who she felt more threatened by, him or the new arrivals.
Help!
Anya turned to see Mackenzie standing behind Teresa. He had his left arm wrapped over her throat, holding her back against him. A flat, black pistol in his right hand was pointed at Anya. Corey launched himself at Mackenzie. Mackenzie swung the pistol and laid the barrel along Corey's temple when he got close. Pole-axed and out on his feet, Corey toppled and lay at Teresa's feet. Teresa struggled against Mackenzie, but it didn't do any good. Anya pointed the rifle, but only the barest profile of Mackenzie's face showed past Teresa's head. He held his pistol against the young woman's neck.
You can't shoot me, Anya. You're not that good. You also don't want me to accidentally pull this trigger. Even if you miss me, I can't say that I won't shoot. These aren't exactly stress-free moments we're enjoying here.
She doesn't have anything to do with this. Let her go.
If I let her go, you might try something stupid.
I was stupid when I took you on for a partner.
Pains me to hear you say that. Matter of fact, if this present situation hadn't gone toxic, I'd have gotten your friends out of here and I'd be a hero.
Who are you working for?
Can't say. I subcontract for a woman who organizes jobs sometimes. This is just something she took on for somebody else, a handoff.
Are you there? I heard you talking to Mackenzie earlier.
She doesn't like talking to people.
She's going to talk to me.
I don't think so.
I'm not going to leave these people here to die.
If you come with me now, they can live. Once those guys figure out you're gone, those men will walk away.
So those people are after me too?
Shit!
We haven't got a whole lot of time. Those men are closing in. I'm the only chance you've got.
Beyond Mackenzie, Yahya dropped into position and pointed his rifle at Anya's face. The young man looked grim and merciless behind the weapon.
Anya Creed!
Not taking her gaze off Mackenzie, Anya spotted one of the parachutists out of the corner of her eye. He was standing in the open. David Smythe, gripped by the hair and on his knees, sat on the ground beside him.
Anya Creed, I am going to shoot this man. Then I am going to shoot another one. Show yourself.
You're not the only way out of here.
Don't be a fool. You can't go out there.
Anya tossed the AK-47 away and rose to her feet with her hands over her head.
Over here!
Those men will kill you when they're done with you.
I don't know that you people aren't planning the same thing.
We want the man responsible for sending them here.
And who would that be?
The parachutist holding David Smythe waved her forward.
This way, Creed!
Conscious of the rifles trained in her direction, Anya started walking.
You want me to kill her?
No, get your team out of there, Dove.
Roger that.
Anya kept walking till she reached Smythe's captor. She studied his features, but she hadn't seen him before. The Middle Eastern heritage was apparent in his dark skin, black hair, and dark eyes.
I'm glad you're being sensible.
The man released Smythe, who fell to the ground. Anya knelt slowly to examine the professor.
David?
I'm all right.
Gingerly, Smythe straightened, but only managed to get to his knees before their captor dropped a gloved hand on his shoulder and kept him down.
Stay there, Professor Smythe. You are going as well.
The gunman swept his gaze over the mountain.
I suppose the men you were with abandoned you.
I don't know.
Well, we will find out soon enough. You may call me James.
Do you work for Habib ibn Thabit?
You will find out what you need to know when the time is right. Give me your phone.
Anya pulled it from her pocket and handed it over. James dropped it on the ground and smashed it underfoot. He waved over two men. One of them forced Anya to her knees and secured her hands behind her back with disposable cuffs. She knelt quietly beside Smythe and scoured the countryside for Mackenzie and his people, but saw nothing.
Anya, who are these people?
I think they work for a man named Habib ibn Thabit.
But who is he?
I don't know.
What does he want with you? With us?
I don't know that either, but I think it has to do with the scroll Mustafa found.
What's the significance of the scroll?
I don't know that either. I only got a piece of it. Have you ever heard of a Muslim historian named Abdelilah Karam?
No. Why?
I wish I knew. But that man, dead for hundreds of years, seems to have started all of this.
But that doesn't make any sense.
Not yet. At first I thought they were just here for the rest of the scroll, but they wouldn't want us if that was true.
Anya studied James, who was talking over a comlink. Several minutes passed, and Anya's knees started aching from the strain of kneeling. She was also conscious of the earwig in her ear canal and her connection to Mackenzie's unseen masters. They probably had a GPS lock on the device as well. Anya looked up and saw James returning, followed by two men. Between them, they forced Mustafa to stumble along. The Bedouin leader's hands were bound behind his back. They threw him on the ground in front of Anya. Bruised and battered, one eye swollen shut, several teeth missing in front, and blood running down his chin, Mustafa still managed to glare at Anya.
I should have killed you the night I saw you.
This is Mustafa?
Yes.
He killed one of my men while they were trying to take him.
Put a knife in my hand and give me the chance to kill another.
James ignored him, then produced the scroll. Anya's heart leaped.
Is this the scroll that was found? The one you have been asking about?
Yes.
James stared at her, then nodded to one of his men, who took Smythe by the arm, pulled him to his feet, and led him a short distance away. James pulled out his knife.
The man I work for wishes to know what you have learned about this scroll. If I get the impression you are lying to me, or holding back, I will have Professor Smythe executed. Do you believe me?
Yes.
Then tell me.
The scroll belonged to Abdelilah Karam, a historian of the Caliphate during Muhammad's reign.
James walked away and said something into his comlink. After a few minutes, James returned to Anya.
What is in this scroll?
I don't know. The only thing I can tell you is that it belonged to Karam. I've traced down other leads to Fez. There was a professor at the university there who studied Karam. I plan to take the scroll there to see if I could get it translated, or at least compared to other examples of his work.
You cannot read the scroll?
No, but if you let me examine it, I might be able to learn something.
For a moment, James hesitated. Then he leaned down behind her, thrusting his face into hers.
If you try to escape, I will have Professor Smythe killed, and I will kill you. Do you understand?
Yes.
James leaned in a little more. Anya felt the cold steel press against her flesh. A second later, the plastic cuffs fell off her wrists. James helped her up.
Remember, if you run, I kill your friend, and you will not get away.
Before Anya could respond, James pulled his pistol. The Bedouin warlord relaxed back against the ground, his face a mask of surprise. Anya got the message. As he holstered his pistol, James looked up. Gazing in the same direction, Anya spotted the two small cargo helicopters speeding toward them. A moment later, the chopping beats of the rotors passed over them. James's men laid down flares to mark out a landing zone. The helicopters set down easily, the rotor wash whipping up a wave of sand and dust. Anya wrapped her arm over her nose and mouth to keep from choking and squinted through the haze. James put an arm on her shoulder and pushed her forward.
Let's go.
Anya took a final look around the mountain. The fires in the Bedouin camp had died down, and four of the tents had been reduced to faintly glowing embers. Burned bodies lay in all of them, though whether they had been killed by flames or gunfire, she didn't know. There was no sign of Mackenzie or his men, but they would be out there watching. She wondered if, had she not been wearing the earwig, they would have killed her, or if they would have gambled on her eventually leading them to Habib ibn Thabit. David Smythe was put on the second helicopter, Anya on the first. As it lifted from the ground, she shook the earwig out of her ear and flicked it through the open cargo bay doors without being noticed, then went to the back of the storage area. She sat on the floor and leaned her head back. She reached out and felt the haft of the sword in the otherwear. Anya was reassured, just knowing it was there. Mackenzie glared down at the earwig at his feet. He knelt and recovered the earwig, closing it in his fist as he lifted his eyes to where the helicopters faded against the Stygian horizon.
Well, that was stupid, Anya.
They found the device?
No, she got rid of it.
What was she thinking?
Does she rather deal with one enemy than a pair of them?
Who does she think is going to help her get out of this?
You haven't seen her operate. She's good. Maybe she doesn't have a taste for blood, but she'll kill to save herself or others. She believes she's going to get herself out of this.
Mackenzie put the earwig in his pocket and waved to his remaining people. He'd lost two more men, cutting his force to seven, not counting him and Yahya. The horses had scattered as soon as the first attack had started, but some of them hadn't gone far. Mackenzie waved Yahya over, and the young man looked up at him expectantly.
Go through the Bedouin camp. Collect whatever weapons Mustafa had and see if you can round up some of those horses for pack animals. Let's salvage as much as we can.
Yahya nodded out at the darkness. The archaeology team was scattered and in hiding, staying well away from Mackenzie and his team. Evidently, they didn't trust anyone.
What about them?
Nah, leave them alone. Let them take whatever water and supplies the Bedouins have that we don't need. They've got enough locals there to survive the walk to Marrakesh. They aren't our problem.
I should have shot that woman when I had the chance.
No.
She's bad luck.
And you picked up too many superstitions from those West Africans you've been hanging around with. That woman is one of the luckiest I've seen. Go get those munitions like I told you.
Yahya frowned, then went without another word.
What are your plans?
If you're not going to provide aerial support...
I don't want to draw Habib's attention in any way.
Then we're going to ride back to Marrakesh and see about securing vehicles.
To go to Fez?
She did mention that that was where she needed to go next to understand that scroll. If we ride all night, we should be in Marrakesh before daybreak. She's not going to be able to get into that university until it opens.
Fez is 250 miles northeast of Marrakesh. By the time you get back to the city, it'll be several more hours till you get to Fez.
Maybe. She might not go there anyway.
We don't have any other leads.
Then I'll go to Fez. Even if she gets there ahead of me, she has to find whatever it is she's looking for. That will take time, too.
Fine. I'm gonna see if I can field an asset or two in the city to help out with the surveillance.
This op is so big, you gotta backstop me?
No, but the costs are starting to mount. You should have been done with this by now.
Mackenzie couldn't think of anything to say to that. He hefted his rifle and walked over to Mustafa's body. Taking a mini maglite from his pocket, he quickly rifled through the dead man's clothing. Aside from some personal items and paper bills and coins, Mackenzie turned up one more item. A scarred brass key, slightly longer than his middle finger, and almost as big around as a pencil. Gripping the key by the barrel, Mackenzie trained the flashlight beam on the end. The writing there had worn down from use, but with a little effort, he could make it out. Arabic. He still couldn't read it. Mackenzie clasped his fist around the key and smiled. Perhaps Anya Creed and Habib did not hold all of the cards. The changing pitch of the helicopter rotors woke Anya from her restless sleep. She lifted her hand to wipe an errant hair from her face, only to discover she had been once again handcuffed. Thankfully, though, her hands were in front of her, which was a lot more comfortable. The cargo door was closed, so she had no idea what they were headed into. Around her, many of Habib's shock troops lay asleep, weapons cradled in their arms. James sat at the front of the cargo area, just behind the cockpit, which was shut off from the rear compartment. He watched her grimly. A few minutes later, the helicopter glided in and touched down. A guard got to his feet and rolled the cargo door open. Anya stared through the open bay at the tarmac around them. The use of the airfield surprised her. She had been expecting a clandestine location. Instead, she could see a city in the distance. David Smythe sat beside her.
That's Fez. Have you ever been here before?
No.
You'd like the city.
Smythe caught himself and grinned ruefully as he glanced around the cargo area as their guards prepared to debark.
Under other circumstances, our present conditions are not conducive to sightseeing. If you look closely, you can see where the old walled city Fez El Bali butts up against the newer sections.
Smythe pointed with his bound hands. The older section looked like a maze crammed roughly into the center of the new buildings. The alabaster stone glowed the orange hue of the morning sun. Bracing her feet, Anya started to rise. One of the guards reached out. He clamped a big hand on top of her head and shoved her back down. The guards had changed clothing during the flight and now wore casual business wear. They carried pistols in shoulder holsters and machine pistols in messenger bags. A few minutes later, three SUVs pulled to a halt on the tarmac. A man with a shopping bag got out of one and approached the helicopter. He handed the bag to James, who quickly glanced inside, then nodded. Before handing Anya the shopping bag, James took out a pair of pants, a shirt, and a lightweight jacket, and gave those things to Smythe. Then he addressed her, pointing to a small compartment in the back of the helicopter where a man had just strung a tarp.
Change your clothing. You must be presentable.
James pulled out a knife and cut the plastic strap that bound Anya's wrists. Not wanting to start an argument, she took the bag and her backpack to the curtained area. She dropped the shopping bag and delved into her backpack. She had a clean t-shirt inside, so she put that on and pulled her hair back in a ponytail. Then she stepped back out from behind the curtain. Smythe stood in the new clothes that he'd been given.
Where are the clothes I gave you?
In the bag. I'm not wearing them.
You don't have a choice.
I do. I'm exercising it.
If you do not do as I say, I will kill this man.
If you want to find out about that scroll, you're not going to do that.
Do not test me.
It's not a test. I'm setting some boundaries. You can keep me a prisoner here, but I'm not going to dress up for you. I'll do what I have to in order to keep David alive, but you and I both know you're not going to harm him unless you have to. Besides that, he probably knows more about this time period and Abdeli Lakaram than I do. What really matters to you?
Bring her and the man. Put them in separate vehicles.
James turned and stepped out of the helicopter. As one of the men reached out to grip her upper arm, Anya slung her backpack over her shoulder and stepped down from the helicopter toward the SUV James had climbed into. One of the guards opened the back door. Anya was directed to the last row of seats. Seated with her backpack at her feet, she watched as Smythe was taken to another vehicle. A few minutes later, they got underway. Startled from his reverie, Garin turned from the rain-streaked window overlooking Potsdamer Platz and the Tiergarten. Garin spotted his current lover's beautiful reflection in the glass. An American, she was a rhythm and blues singer starting to build an audience in the U.S. and Europe. When his sat phone rang on the side table, Garin scooped it up at once, saw that the call came from the agency he was using to find Anya, and answered.
Yes?
We have news of the Creed woman. She's still in Morocco. Apparently she's been captured by Habib ibn Thabit's men and has landed in Fez.
Get me transport there.
Already waiting, sir.
Garin punched off the sat phone and pushed up from the bed. His lover mounted a protest, but Garin's mind was already filled with arrangements for the Morocco trip. The SUV caravan had to slow as it approached the old city of Fez El Bali, sandwiched in the new. When Fez had been built at the turn of the 8th century, it had been constructed for carts to travel the narrow, twisting streets along the banks of the Fez River. Anya glanced over her shoulder at the two SUVs that trailed hers. When she turned back to face forward, she found Jamez scowling at her.
Do not even think about it.
Think about what?
You are useful only as long as you are controllable, Creed. Remember that.
What does your employer want? It would help if I knew what I was looking for.
What is it you normally look for?
Everything.
Then look for that.
Jamez turned back around to face front. Anya reached into her backpack and took out her journal. Diligently, she went back over her notes. It didn't take her long to realize, again, that she simply didn't have enough information to form a hypothesis. Parking hadn't been a consideration when the University of Al-Karouin had been built in 859. Judging from Jamez's scowl when they had to leave the SUVs in private parking, he hadn't known about that. He assigned two men to Anya and another two to Smythe, making sure they were kept separate. Other guards trailed along on the opposite side of the narrow street, in front and behind. Their coats disguised machine pistols. Anya approached the university with mixed feelings. Smythe had promised to spend a day with her here. The university was still considered, by some, to be the oldest continually operating academic institution in the world. The architecture was ancient, all keyhole doorways, towers, and peaked roofs. It had begun as a mosque, funded by the daughter of a wealthy merchant. In its early days, there were classes on religious instruction and political discussion, which had been tightly intertwined. And still were. Nearer the university, Jamez changed directions and headed right, toward one of the buildings away from the main entrance. Anya was weighing her chances of calling out for help to the young men who were obviously security guards standing at the door when Jamez and the entourage were waved inside. Anya followed Jamez through the beautifully tiled corridor. Few students were up this early in the day. Display cases lined the hallway with books, scrolls, and other artifacts. After traveling through a maze of corridors, they arrived at a small library. Jamez waved his men into place.
Wait here and watch her.
Anya gazed out over the stacks of books that filled the center of the low-ceilinged room. There were desks with computers on them at the front and back of the room, and a small office equipped with photocopy equipment. An elderly librarian returned with Jamez. He was thin and elegant, with a neatly trimmed salt-and-pepper beard, sad eyes, and an easy smile.
Good morning. I am Professor Mahfoud Daoudi, and I will be assisting you. I am told that you wish to see the journals left by Professor Ulker Bozdah.
Yes, I'm Anya Creed.
My wife loves your show. She said if she had known history could be so interesting, she would have paid attention to me a long time ago.
I'm flattered.
Now, if you'll accompany me, I'll take you to the Bozdah holdings.
Daoudi took off at a spry pace, and Anya fell into step with him.
Ulker Bozdah isn't a well-known writer. Would you mind telling me about your interest in the man?
I'm not so much interested in Bozdah as I am his research on Abdelilah Karam. Have you heard of him?
Sadly, I am not a student of Bozdah. I don't know of anyone here who is. Until the call I got last night, I was not really aware that we had anything by him in the collections. As you might imagine, we have numerous holdings.
I'm sorry about that call last night.
A little bit of excitement in an otherwise boring day. I was given to understand that this was a favor for one of our benefactors.
The professor stopped and walked down an aisle. Gently, he took books from the shelf and passed them to Anya. She wiped off the dust and looked at the covers. Time had yellowed the pages, and the books felt fragile. Anya looked at the sketched image of an androgynous angel with a flourish of peacock feathers spreading its wings. Its title was The Order of the Peacock Angel, a summary of apocalyptic warnings that have been ignored.
Thankfully, the book was in English.
These are first editions?
They are. I have a small room you can use.
That would be great.
Please, follow me.
Daoudi led the way, and Anya followed him as she leafed through one of the books. James sat in a straight-backed chair near the door of the small office space Daoudi had guided them to. She and Smythe each sat at one of the two tables and divided the books between them. Two large picture windows overlooked the main library area. Maps of Fez and Morocco lined the walls under glass covers. The maps were decades old and depicted the various stages of the country's formation and documented the events that had shaped its colorful history.
How much longer will this take?
You're welcome to start reading with us. This is a lot of material to cover, and we don't know what we're looking for. If you want to do something productive, you might send out for lunch. We're going to be here for a while.
James got up and walked out. The three guards he'd assigned to watch Anya and Smythe remained in place. Habib ibn Thabit stood on the flying deck of his yacht as she sailed through the gray-green waters of the Mediterranean Sea and listened to James on his sat phone.
Anya tells me she does not know how long this will take.
What she is looking for has been hidden for a very long time, my friend.
She says it would help if she knew what she was looking for.
Just have her keep searching.
Every minute we spend here increases our risk of discovery. The people that sent the mercenary, Mackenzie, will still be searching for us. And if they find us, they will find you.
You would give me up so easily?
No, of course not.
It gladdens my heart to hear that. Have patience with her. Give her more time.
It has been hours.
That only means that she is hours closer to finding that which we seek. I will reward you handsomely for your efforts when this is done.
I don't do this for the reward. I do this to strike back at our enemies.
Then know that this is part of that effort.
Habib broke the connection. He stared out at the sea with his hands behind his back.
Sir?
Yes?
There is an unpleasant development in Fez.
What?
A covert team is en route to the city. I only just learned of this.
The Americans?
The British. They have an MI6 strike team within 3 hours of the city.
How did they find us?
I believe someone within the CIA alerted them. I have only been able to get a little information about the operation. It appears the attack on the Bedouin attracted more attention than we had believed. Should we tell James?
No. The work he is doing there with the American archaeologist is important. If they are not finished in 3 hours' time, and the British close in on them, then James will put a bullet through Anya Creed's head.
I think I've found something.
Head aching from lack of sleep and sustained intense reading, Anya pushed up from her seat and joined David Smythe at his table. James hurried over too. He had sat quietly for the past 2 hours, but Anya sensed his growing tension. He kept his hand on the gun at his hip under the jacket.
Bozdar evidently tracked down another book that had entries regarding Abdelilah Karam.
Why, if there was so much interest in this guy, have we never heard of him?
You know as well as I do that we don't know everything. In some ways, history is like space. We really know very little about it except what's around us. The further you go back, in the case of history, the less we know. This is only 1,300 years, as opposed to figuring out, for example, what happened 11,000 years ago when Atlantis was reputedly still above the Atlantic.
If it was the Atlantic...
Exactly. Though I am of the opinion that in our present location, we aren't that far from the...
Silence! You chatter like children! What have you found?
As I was saying, Bozdar was evidently basing some of his research on work another historian had done. This other historian, Miskuwai, was writing a history of Adi ibn Musafir al-Umawi. Do you know who that was?
12th century Sheikh of Kurdistan. A descendant of Marwan ibn al-Hakam, the fourth Umayyad caliph, reappointed as caliph by Muawiyah I after Ali removed him.
Exactly. And you recognize the significance of Muawiyah, right? His rule was the first caliphate after Muhammad died. That succession split the Islamic people.
Muawiyah was a usurper, a traitor to the beliefs of our people. He seized leadership, but did not have God's ear. Only the true family of Muhammad has that. This person you are reading about is a false prophet. What you read there is doubtless lies.
Lies or not, do you want us to continue?
Continue, but you are wading in sacrilege.
According to this, Al-Ummawi was supposed to have a book written by Abdelilah Karom concerning some of the events after Uthman's murder.
It was not murder. His death came as a result of true believers trying to bring our people back to God.
Maybe it would be better if we did this on our own.
Hamez stood his ground. Anya reached for her tablet PC, disconnecting it from the wall outlet where she was charging it, and started saving images of the sections concerning Karom.
Where does the Melek Taus fit into this?
Smythe turned the page to reveal the black-and-white illustration of an androgynous angel with spreading peacock wings.
Because Sheikh Adi ibn Musaifa founded the Melek Taus and was believed to be an incarnation of the peacock angel.
Anya leaned down and examined the drawing, finally placing her finger on a line of script.
This looks like an artist's signature.
Smythe picked up the magnifying glass he'd borrowed from Daoudi.
If it is, I can't read it. It's in Arabic. Maybe you can.
Carefully, as though this was a trick, Hamez leaned down to read.
Atta ibn Wasaf.
I've never heard of him, but he seems to have collaborated with Bozdar on this book as well as the other one I've been through.
Curious, Anya returned to the three books on her table.
Wasaf illustrated one of these books, which is about Karam and the spread of Islam into Morocco. We need to speak with Daoudi.
Daoudi led the way through the stacks, Anya trailing the scholar's heels. She already had an armload of books.
As it turns out, Atta ibn Wasaf was a popular illustrator of Moroccan books. He worked on a number of projects involving religious studies.
According to our files, Wasaf died 9 years ago.
Where?
Here in Fez. He only left the country a few times. He studied art at Oxford.
Do you know when he was there?
In the 1960s.
17 books littered the two tables in the small office. Anya and Smythe had divvied them up. Wasaf's skill was amazing. He'd illustrated histories, children's stories, and maps. Anya was going through a child's book about the white horse, Al-Burak. It contained several plates of the prophet and the winged animal. In compliance with Muslim belief, Wasaf had left depictions of Muhammad faceless. In Persian art, the horse was nearly always given a human head and features. The dedication in the children's book caught Anya's eye. It was written in Arabic as well as English. To my father, Wasaf ibn Fadlan, who first showed me his angel and taught me to draw. Anya returned to Daoudi's desk with Hamez, her entourage.
Wasaf's father was an illustrator too.
Daoudi read something off his computer.
Yes, we have some of his books as well.
May we see them?
Of course.
After writing the reference number down, Daoudi quickly found the books illustrated by Wasaf ibn Fadlan. Consumed by curiosity, Anya sat on the floor and leafed through the books as quickly as she could. Wasaf ibn Fadlan hadn't been as popular as his son. There were only 3 books in the university collection, but one of them was about the peacock angel. The illustration of the figure was much like the one Atta ibn Wasaf had drawn in Bozdah's book, but there were differences. Smythe peered over Anya's shoulder.
Same source material, don't you think?
We can't ignore the possibility.
What are you talking about?
Anya pointed at the illustration of the angel in the book.
This looks like the same angel that was in the other book.
They were father and son. Perhaps the father taught the son.
And perhaps there is a source document.
You are grasping at straws.
When artists sketch the statue of David, it tends to look the way Michelangelo sculpted it. Whoever your boss is, he seems to be pretty concerned about what's going on. Is he the kind of boss that would want every stone overturned or not?
What do you need?
To know if either of these two artists left any journals or personal information about their work.
Anya returned to the desk to find Daoudi once more.
Sorry, last question, I think.
Of course.
What can you tell me about the family of these two artists?
I am afraid I probably cannot help you with that. Unless the family contributed the artist's personal things for the collection here.
Daoudi consulted the computer and smiled.
Ah, you are in luck. I have both an address and a telephone number.
Great.
May I call for you? I cannot just give out that information without permission.
Of course, please.
Daoudi reached for the phone and punched in the number.
Yes, this is Professor Daoudi at the university. I would like to speak. Someone is there after all, Miss Creed.
The conversation continued in Darija and in a dialect Anya couldn't follow. But when they were finished speaking, Daoudi turned to her, beaming.
It seems that Iskandar Ibn Siladar would be delighted to see you. He is another fan of your television show.
Garin stepped off the private plane and accepted the keys to the Land Rover that a well-dressed young man held out for him.
Welcome to Fez, Mr. Brayden. I hope you enjoy your stay in our city.
Thank you.
Your agency said you would not be needing a guide through the city.
I won't. I know my way around.
I see.
Garin unlocked the door and swung inside. He started the engine, and dropping the transmission into gear, he gunned it.
Yes?
Anya Creed is leaving the university.
Why?
I do not know, Mr. Brayden. You asked us to keep at a discreet distance.
Is she still with Ames?
Yes, and his men. Quite a few men, it would appear. We should have gotten more men ourselves. It is not too late to add them.
No, we stay small. We stay invisible until we act.
Yes, sir.
Are you prepared?
Of course.
His hired man gave Garin the address where to meet him. Garin knew where it was. He had, after all, been in Fez many times. And as he had been previously, Garin was here once more to kill someone. Mackenzie sat inside a small tea house across from Al-Karouin, connected to Sophie on his earwig. Only a few customers were at the other tables, but business was brisk this morning as many students got their orders to go. Tracking Anya Creed to the university was a no-brainer. She was an archaeologist searching for missing information. It stood to reason she would turn up here. Mackenzie and the surviving members of his team had arrived only an hour ago, but they didn't have to look too hard before they recognized Hamez's men positioned in a loose perimeter around the school. Yahya sat on the other side of the table. Mackenzie watched the MI6 agent familiar to him from past encounters.
We're not alone.
What do you mean?
I've just spotted a British team in the area.
Who?
Rawlison.
Mackenzie pointed the small camcorder on the table toward the man. A satellite link had been hidden within the camera's housing to transmit images or straight video for short periods of time. Felix Rawlison looked like a rugby player, short and powerfully built, but he was a man who could be easily overlooked in a crowd. He was dark, possibly biracial, with cropped hair and a short, full beard. A scar bisected his left eyebrow and trailed down his cheek.
We see him. Impressive scar.
I gave it to him.
He'll know you if he sees you.
Yeah, I nearly took his eye out, and he almost cost me a kidney. He's a dangerous guy.
Not being able to hide in plain sight is a problem for you.
The flip side is that I recognize Rawlison, and I now know the Brits are here. He could have walked in blind to whatever's coming. By the way, what is coming? Why are the Brits here?
They want your real target as much as we do.
Mackenzie watched Rawlison sitting next to a building as if he were only taking advantage of the shade there. A careful scan of the surrounding neighborhood told Mackenzie that MI6 had at least 7 agents working the scene, and more would doubtlessly be posted around the university campus.
Rawlison and his people have the numbers to make a snatch, or we could throw in with them.
This is one the boys at MI6 won't want to share. That's not acceptable.
We still have the key.
But we don't know how the key fits into this, or even if it does. And that could be something we want to keep off the table.
No luck with the key, then?
Not yet. We're still searching.
Across the street, Rawlison's head came up. It was just enough to tip Mackenzie off. Tracking Rawlison's line of sight, Mackenzie spotted Anya Creed walking out of the university, surrounded by Habib's men. Mackenzie stood and felt the weight of his pistol resting comfortably on his hip under his jacket.
I gotta move.
Understood. Be advised that our technological presence there is limited.
Only blocks from the university, Garin swept the street corners at the irregular intersection and spotted the slim-built young Moroccan standing at the corner just short of the confluence of streets. He carried a duffel bag. It wasn't who he'd been expecting. Garin unlocked the door and the young man got in. As soon as the door closed, Garin got underway again. Garin navigated around vendors and pedestrians as he rolled through the streets. The GPS held him on course to the university. The young man pulled on his seatbelt and sat quietly. He was in his early 20s, hard-bodied, with muscular, calloused hands. His face was slightly rounded, his beard cut short, and his eyes almost dark enough to look black. He wore jeans and an X-Men t-shirt, allowing him to be mistaken for a local or a tourist.
Did you get everything?
In answer, the guy unzipped the duffel bag and revealed the gleaming, oily black surfaces of the weapons inside. There was a small selection of pistols and three assault rifles with the butts telescoped in to shrink their size.
Which would you prefer?
Something big.
Desert Eagle, 50 caliber, hard to acquire, but for you, the very best.
He took the huge pistol out and offered the weapon to Garin.
Loaded?
Of course.
Garin took the pistol and shoved it under his thigh. He placed the extra magazines for the weapon in his pockets.
What's your name?
Kortubi. Your target has picked up two other teams that are pursuing him.
Do you know who they are?
One team belongs to the CIA, as you suggested. The other is British. They have received information from local assets who owe my family favors. Our goal here is to save the woman?
Yes.
And the others?
If they get in the way, we kill them. Is that acceptable?
Of course. I hope you're as good as you are said to be.
Close enough.
In the back of the SUV again, Anya flipped through the images she'd stored on her tablet PC. Once more, she and Smythe had been split up. Frustrated, she returned the device to her backpack and relaxed into the seat. She had almost dropped off to sleep, despite the vehicles careering through the narrow streets, when it came to an abrupt stop. Anya blinked her eyes open and rubbed them with her palms. The SUV caravan had pulled to a stop in a narrow alley. Doorways opened into courtyards off the alley on either side, but the doors were all closed. The few pedestrians quickly gave ground to the large vehicles. With the SUV parked against the wall on her side, Anya couldn't open the door. She slid across the seat and got out on the other side. Anya automatically reached for her backpack and shrugged into it. One of the doorways on her left opened, and an Arabic man in his early 30s peered out at her.
Miss Anya Creed.
I am. Mr. Silidar?
Please, call me Iskandar. I feel as though I know you.
Anya walked toward him, and James matched her every step. David Smythe and two other guards followed. Seeing all the people converging on him, James and his guards looking so somber, Iskandar drew back.
It's okay. They're with me.
They are your friends?
More like associates.
All right. I really was not expecting so many people. The man at the university implied that you would be the only one to come calling.
Reluctantly, Iskandar pulled the door open. Feeling guilty at bringing trouble to the man's doorstep, Anya stepped into the small courtyard. There were flowers, fruit trees, and in the center, a small fountain. Iskandar looked nervously at James and the other two men.
The man at the library...
Professor Daoudi, yes.
He said you were interested in documents my family might have retained from my grandfather and great-grandfather.
Yes, I know that the university has some of their materials, but I was hoping there might be more.
You are putting together a museum show?
Not exactly.
Then what are you doing with these materials?
Research for a project.
What project?
Do you have materials such as Miss Creed suggests?
There are some materials that my family has been holding onto. You are fortunate to have come here. My two older brothers...
James strode forward and took Iskandar by one arm. Iskandar had to skip to keep up.
Let us go get those materials. Time is an issue.
Of course. No problem.
Anya started to follow. James fixed her with his gaze.
Stay there. You two make sure she does.
In a few minutes, Iskandar and James returned. Iskandar carried a large cardboard box and looked apologetic as he set everything in front of Anya. She hunkered down with him and began to go through books and journals.
I thought you would have better mannered associates.
I apologize for that. You got me on a bad day.
The journals and moleskin notebooks were filled with illustrations and sketches of works in progress at the time, or of places the two artists had visited. But there was also a bundle of letters tied to an old book. The letters had been addressed to Wasaf ibn Fadlan, the older artist. Most of them dated back to the 1920s.
My father thought they belonged in a museum, but my mother, she was the daughter of Atta ibn Wasaf, insisted they were family possessions and should be honored.
So a cardboard box was the best you could do for these honorable things?
I got these 2 years ago, after my mother died. I did not know what to do with them. My brothers did not want them.
Anya flipped through the book that had been tied to the letters.
They're in good shape.
I did not ask for this. I did not ask for any of this.
Anya's heart sped up a little when she saw the title page of the journal. The peacock angel soared over a desert landscape where a woman sat on a camel and faced an army of swordsmen.
Have you studied these?
Yes, many times.
Iskandar sidled around to Anya as James peered over their shoulders.
My mother was my great-grandfather's favorite. She loved to draw, to paint. While he was alive, he taught her. She always said this was my great-grandfather's special book.
What made it special?
My great-grandfather was a man of peace. He believed in the future of Islam and that we needed to all once more learn to live in peace.
Anya turned the page and found another drawing of the woman on the camel, this one much closer and more detailed.
This drawing is of the war that split the Muslim people.
The Battle of the Camel. But what is the peacock angel doing there?
My great-grandfather told my mother that out of this battle came the knowledge of the peacock angel.
Adi ibn Musayfir al-Umawi was the founder of the peacock angel.
Not many people know that history.
I've been learning a lot about it lately.
I do not know much about it myself.
It is godless blasphemy, a celebration of shaitan. Those people are wrongly turned.
Anya didn't comment. She continued leafing through the pages. Several contained head-and-shoulder sketches of major players in the struggle to inherit Muhammad's mantle. She had Iskandar translate, quickly learning to recognize the names of Aisha, Muhammad's young widow, Ali ibn Abi Talib, the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, and Uthman ibn Affan, the third caliph, who was assassinated by rebels supporting Ali's claims to be the next caliph. A few more pages into the journal, Anya found a page with an old man's face and a familiar name, even in Arabic, under it. This sketch showed the man in his older years, with a long beard, hollow, haunted eyes, and thin shoulders.
Do you know him?
Abdulillah Karam. My mother said this man was a historian, and that he was the man who knew the secret.
What secret?
She said my great-grandfather hoped to tell the story of the battle for Caliph, that he might be able to bring the Muslim people together once more. Keep going, there are the sketches.
Anya saw several images depicting armed men climbing over a courtyard wall. Once they were in the courtyard, they advanced on the main house. Over the next few pages, more violence ensued, some of it very graphic.
This is my great-grandfather's interpretation of the assassination of Uthman, the third caliph. It is a very horrible thing, is it not?
Yes.
But my great-grandfather was a brilliant artist. These are just thumbnails, sketches. It would have been wonderful to see these fully realized.
Yes.
Anya turned more pages and discovered yet another assassination. The sketch showed a regal figure kneeling in prayer with an armed man poised to strike him with a sword from behind. In the next sketch, he was pierced with the sword, but in the one after that, he was still fighting. At the end of the sequence, guards had the assassin in custody while the praying man lay upon the ground.
This is the assassination of Ali?
Yes. The assassin was Abd al-Rahman ibn Muljam, a Karajite seeking revenge for some fight.
The Battle of Sifayin.
Perhaps. My mother said that during the battle, Ali declared a truce, but the Karajites did not agree.
The Karajites believed God would declare the victor, and Ali had turned away from the will of God. That was why they later assassinated him after he became caliph.
They and all their descendants should have been executed and their blood spilled on the ground.
Arabic script flowed across the next few pages, leading finally to a section written in Kufic, the same language used in the scroll.
Do you know what this says?
The Arabic part, of course. It is about this man Karam. As I said, he was a historian. It says Karam was driven from his homeland. He spent time among the Yazidi people in Sinjar to get peace after the bloodshed he had seen. It also mentions that he brought his histories with him and that there were people pursuing him to destroy those books.
Why?
Because of the secret, whatever it was.
Anya pointed to the section in Kufic.
Do you understand any of this?
No. My mother said she could not translate it.
Did your great-grandfather translate this?
I don't know. Possibly. My mother said he was very good with languages.
Is there any chance a translation exists within this material?
If it is there, I have never seen it.
How closely have you looked through these things?
I am a carpenter. If you want a house built or reconstruction done, I can do those things.
Would it be possible for me to borrow these? I promise to get them back to you.
My mother wanted me to take care of them.
Do you need these books?
I can take images of them if he wants to keep the physical copies.
We do not have time for that. Take the box.
James nodded to one of the guards. The man bent and lifted the box.
Wait! They do not belong to you!
Iskandar stood and started after the guard. James whirled. He tripped Iskandar to the ground. James drew his pistol and pointed it at the man's head. Anya stepped forward and hammered James's arms to the side with her forearm. James spun on Anya, who raised her hands.
You don't have to kill him.
You do not tell me whom I may kill and whom I may not.
Anya kept her mouth shut and her hands in the air. The young man stayed put. James lowered his pistol and nodded toward the courtyard entrance.
Go.
Anya walked toward the doorway, listening for the gunshot that she feared might come. But they walked out into the alleyway without incident. She didn't let out a breath until the courtyard door closed behind her. One of the guards opened the SUV door. Anya slid in, trapped into place by the guard who had opened the door, while the second man put the box in the back. James slid into the driver's seat and was starting to move into the passenger seat. The man standing beside the open door sagged. His head rained down in pieces around him. Garin had trailed the SUV caravan easily because it stood out in the neighborhood, and he'd chosen to watch them from an alley two blocks away.
Sniper.
He has to be on the rooftop.
There.
Kurtubi pointed at one of the buildings ahead of them. Three stories tall, it loomed over the caravan. A muzzle barrel barely broke the line of the roof's edge.
Good eyes. CIA or MI6?
Low-velocity rounds to keep them subsonic, as well as a silencer. My guess would be the bridge.
Mine too.
Garin engaged the transmission. Kurtubi picked up one of the Belgian-made FN-FAL assault rifles he'd brought. The man in the back of the SUV tried to chamber out, but a bullet to the back of his head dropped him.
Can you distract the sniper?
Kurtubi opened his door, threw out a leg to brace himself as he sighted with the rifle, and fired two quick shots. Both bullets chipped the roof's edge just below the rifle barrel, which disappeared almost instantly. Satisfied with his marksmanship, Kurtubi slid back into the Land Rover.
I do not think I was seen.
Garin watched the alley and spotted Anya climbing over the seats in the SUV. Freedom was just a few seconds away.